for those of you who are parents, this is your day. This is your favorite mitzvah. Because now we're on mitzvah Lamed Yimel, the 33rd mitzvah, which is Kibud Avim. So, on the one hand, parents are going to learn exactly what the mitzvah of Kibud Avim entails, which is good for them to know what to expect of their children. But the disappointing thing is that Kibud Avim, contrary to the way some parents tend to use it, is that it doesn't mean that you have to listen to everything your parents say all the time without question. We're going to figure out what it exactly does mean right now. So the Sefer Chinuch starts out, L'chabed ha'av ha'im. The mitzvah is to honor one's mother and one's father. There's also a mitzvah later on in Sefer Vayikra, Parshas Kedoshim, where it says, "Each ish imo v'aviv tiro," that one has to fear one's parents as well. So that mitzvah has very different parameters from the mitzvah to honor them. As it said, again, in the Ten Commandments, the fifth of the Ten Commandments, the famous explanation that the first five commandments are Bein Adam LaMakom, they're between man and God, and the last five commandments are Bein Adam LaChaveru, between a person and a fellow people. So the question is, why does Kibud Avim fall under the first five commandments, the fifth commandment? The question is that the answer that people give is that really when you're honoring your parents, you're really honoring God too, and it's part of the mitzvah, as Sefer Chinuch is going to explain more. It's almost a part of the mitzvah of honoring God, honoring your parents, because it's the triangle of the three that caused you to come into existence. Ubaha perush, ezehu kibud, what does kavod mean, as opposed to the other mitzvah, which is mora, or fearing one's parents. But the kibud, what is ka'abedas avicha v'esimecha mean? Ma'achilu mashke, means you have to feed them and give them to drink. Malbishu mechase, you have to clothe them. Machnes umotzi, and if they're unable to on their own, and they want to leave their house or go in, you have to literally help them get out and help them get to where they need to go. So in other words, it's things that very generally are things you do for them to show them honor directly. So it's not, again, it's not listening to whatever they say, obeying all their commands, it's helping them with bodily necessities. So the distinction between this and mora avim, or fearing one's parents, so the halachos, for example, not calling one's parent by their first name, not sitting in one's parent's place in the house, and not openly disagreeing with them in a disrespectful way, that would all fall under the issue of mora avim, not kibud avim. Kibud avim is doing specific actions for them. It's not the general respect. We honor it. We translate it as honor or respect. Mm-hmm. So it's not the general respect one has to have for them. It's specific things that one has to do in order to honor them. Mishur she mitzvah zo. What are the reasons for this mitzvah? Shiroi lo la'adam sheyakir v'igmol chesed l'misha asa imotova. That it's to instill within us the midah, the proper character trait that one should show hakara satov, that one should recognize the good things that people do for you and act accordingly. You shouldn't be someone disgusting and who makes things foreign that shouldn't be and ungrateful. This character trait is bad and disgusted in all manner of ways. Before Elifnei Elokim Vanashim, not only do people find this character trait particularly annoying, but also God is the same way. Just like when you do something very nice for someone and they don't even bother to say thank you or don't bother to show their gratitude, that's a terrible character trait. It really gets under your skin. I did this fantastic thing for this person. They don't even say a simple thank you. That's a thing we should all keep in mind. Also in general, not just for parents, but for all people to show proper gratitude. But this mitzvah, particularly that this exists, is to instill within us, as the Sefer Chinuch likes to point out, that the mitzvahs, he likes to sort of try to analyze the rational approaches to understanding each mitzvah, so to instill within us the proper character trait of proper gratitude. V'shiyita nalibo, and you should put your focus on the fact, ki ha'av ha'im hem siba seyoso bo'olam. Obviously, you would not exist without your parents. It's incumbent upon you to do for them any honor and any positive thing that you can. Ki heim heviyuhu la'olam, they brought you into the world, and not only did they just bring you in and deposit you on someone's doorstep, in most cases at least, they also gam yagu bo kama yegios bekatnuso. They exerted themselves for your sake when you're a young child. So when you're a baby, you absolutely cannot take care of yourself in any way. And your parents get up in the middle of the night, and they feed you, and they calm you, and they make sure you receive a proper education, and they pay for your tuition. So all these things, the parents work very hard for you. So not only did they just bring you in, they also, you should show gratitude for the fact that they worked hard at it. Because just making the baby isn't that hard. It's the raising the baby that's much more difficult and much more worthy of gratitude even than one's physical existence. Uchsheyikba zos hamida benafsho, yala mimeno lahakir tova sakel baruchu. And once you instill this character trait within yourself, you are going to start recognizing better God. Shehu sibas sibaso v'sibas kol avosav ad ha'adam harishon. That no person, all the way from us back till the first before Adam, would exist without the intervention of God. V'sheotzio la'avir ha'olam v'sipek tzarko kol yamav. And God brought you out into the world. In other words, you could have, pregnancy, and then there are complications in delivery. That could also happen. And that God also helped you come out of that and actually see the world. But tzipek tzorcho kol yamav, and not only that, God makes sure you had all your needs. V'hamidu al maskunto shlemo sevarav. God made sure that you develop properly. V'nosan bo nefesh yodasu maskeles. This the parents don't have as much say in, but God gave you a soul that is knowing and able to understand and it can absorb knowledge. So that part is God's role in your creation and development. Shiluli hanefesh shechananu hakel yekesus keferet in oven. If you didn't have your soul, you'd just be like a horse or a mule that can understand. V'yaruch v'machshavto kama v'chama roi lo lihizor b'avodaso baruchu. So once you, through honoring your parents, you're going to come more to the understanding that you have to honor God as well, that you have to be extremely careful in serving God and honoring Him, and certainly not being ungrateful. In other words, denying worship of God is being ungrateful to the fact that God is at least part of the reason for your existence on this earth. Dinei HaMitzvah. The halachas of the mitzvah are as follows. Kigon kibudze minichse mi chayev lasoso. So who, in other words, your parent needs food. So who has to pay for the food? Is it you or your parent? Imi shalav, imi shalatzma. Do you have to pay for yourself, or can you use your father's money, or your mother's money, whatever, to pay for the food and then bring it to him and feed him? Halacha, how do we paskin? Is a disagreement. Mishel av imyesh nechasim lav. Actually, if your father is able to pay for it, mother is able to pay for it, you actually don't have to use your own money. You're entitled to take some of your parents' money and buy the food or buy the clothing and bring it to them and make sure that they're taken care of properly. That's if the father can afford it. Vim lav yechazer abein afilo apsachim v'yachil aviv. Then obviously it would be preferable if the son would buy it, if the father can't afford it, if the son could, or the child, could afford it to buy it him or herself. But if that's also not going to be happening, then you even have to go around collecting charity in order to fulfill the mitzvah of kibud avim, in order to pay for food and clothing for your parents. The kibud avim is a kodim, which is... comes first, honoring your father or your mother. So in theory, both are absolutely equal. But you have another issue that comes into play here, which is that was the assumption that in the ancient world, to a certain extent now, it is also that the wife is also obligated to serve her husband Most of the time it was the husband who would be going out to work and the wife would stay home and prepare the meals and she would serve him. So since the father and since the wife and the children are both obligated to honor the husband or slash father, so therefore, if let's say your parents both text you at the same time saying that they want a glass of water, so you go give the glass of water to your father first, because the mother is also would also be obligated to go give the father a glass of water if he had asked her directly. So you go give your father first the glass of water, then your mother. So that takes precedence. However, if your parents are not married, then it's exactly equal. You can do whichever one you want. You can give to your mother first, you give to your father first, whichever is more convenient, whichever one you like better. I don't know. Also, by the way, there's speaking of extensions of Kibud Aveim, there's also a halacha that one has to respect one's older brother in a manner that Rambam calls it midivrei sofrim, which is a little bit of an ambiguous expression in the Rambam, whether it's derabanan, whether it's sort of deraisa, or learned out from the Torah in one of the manners, the methods of darshaning the Torah, exactly, not exactly clear what status that has per se, but there is also halacha that one has to honor one's older brother in the same way that one would honor one's parents. Obviously, the mitzvah of honoring one's parents certainly comes first, but one's older brother is also in the equation. The ad heichan kibud aveim, how far do you have to go to respect your parents? And this is alluding to the halacha that even if your parents are mevaze you, let's say I'm in the middle of giving my shiur, and one of my parents comes in, and they rip off my tie and my jacket, and they throw it on the ground and stomp on it, and slap me in the face, then I cannot do anything. I have to be silent, and I'm not allowed to say anything against them, because I have to honor them, even if they do things against me that are very embarrassing. Obviously, you're allowed to protect yourself from bodily harm if they're going to... Right, it's even if, let's say, they take... That's more mora, you're right. So let's say even if they take your wallet and throw it into the ocean... I mean, those are the examples they give. They are a little bit... they're more a little bit mora intended, but that's what he means over here. That even if they're terribly mevaze you, even if they do something that's really... Yeah, that's another example. One is given by Kiba, one is given by Mora. Exactly that. You even have to honor and fear them if they do something. One is the wallet, and one is the coming up and tearing off your clothes or something. But that's true. Even if they take your wallet and throw it into the sea, you cannot do anything about it. You have to be silent. But what happens if your parents are crazy, let's say, at Heichan? Let's say if your parents are really crazy, you're still not allowed to disrespect them. What you have to do if they get really unmanageable is you're allowed to put them in a home, basically. You're allowed to say, I can't deal with this without going crazy myself. You're allowed to put them into someone else's care and not deal with it yourself, even though technically you have the halacha that you personally have to feed them and things like that. If they really get unmanageable, that would not apply. Also, if your parents ask you to do something completely unreasonable, that is also not considered within the purview of Kibud Aveim, and it's subject, obviously, to a lot of discretion to determine what is considered an unreasonable thing for your parents to ask of you. Yeah, let's say I'm in New York and my parents are in Maryland, so if they say, they call me up and they say, I want a glass of water, I say, okay, go to the sink and fill it up. So they say, no, I want you to bring it to me. I'm in bed. I don't want to get out. I want you to come and bring it to me. So that's not a reasonable request. I don't have to go travel to Maryland to give my parents a glass of water. That is unreasonable. But again, you have to take it on a case-by-case basis, what's considered an unreasonable request and what not. So also, what happens if your parents are evil people? You still have to honor them, even if they're completely—they're just really bad people. Let's say nowadays, if you're a lot of Bali Tshuva nowadays, let's say you're from and your parents are not from, so do you still have to honor them? So that is subject to somewhat of a machlokas, but the way we really paskin, the way we assume, is that if your parents are not religious, it's still all the halachos of Kibud Avaim still apply. Especially, of course, if they're strong atheists and making war on religion, then there may be one more to discuss, although maybe you should still be mechabed them. But if they're just not firm because they didn't grow up that way or they are tempted by the outside world, then it would still apply. The machal al kivodo im yamachul, the parents are allowed to say that they don't want the kibud. They're allowed to say that you don't have to honor them. V'im yirenu over al divrei Torah be'ez eloshon yimnaehu. Let's say you see one of your parents violating a precept of the Torah. So you're not supposed to, if they're about to eat something that they're not supposed to eat, you're not supposed to just whack it out of their hand and say no, wag their finger. No, it's not kosher, you're not allowed to eat that. You're not supposed to do that. What you're supposed to do, if it was someone, I wouldn't necessarily recommend doing that with someone else either. But if you, technically, it wouldn't be prohibited, I guess, if you weren't embarrassing them. But if you're not allowed to do that to your parents. So if you see your parents violating a precept of the Torah, what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to break it to them in as respectful a way possible, saying, for example, make it as if you're asking them what the halacha is. Oh, doesn't it say in the Torah somewhere that you're not allowed to do X, Y, and Z? You know, Tati, please remind me. And he says, maybe it does say that. Oh, I hope I didn't just see that. I was, anyway. So that's what you're supposed to do about that. V'mitzaveyu aviv lavor al divrei Torah. Let's say your parents ask you to do something or tell you to do something that is against the Torah, even if it's a rabbinic prohibition. You could say that kibud avayim is a deraisa and the rabbinic prohibition is only a derabanan, but you don't say that. Shelo yaminu b'zeh, that you just don't listen, because obviously the same God who commanded us to honor our parents is who commanded us to do all the rest of the Torah. So the mitzvahs are the same. And God, the rabbinic mitzvahs are part of the greater system of the Torah over which the parents have no jurisdiction to tell you to do otherwise. Also, there's a discussion amongst the poskim. Let's say you want to marry someone and your parents oppose the match. So while it's recommended to listen to them, technically it's not kibud. You don't, like I said, you don't have to listen to whatever they say. If you really think that this is the right shidduch for you, this is the right job, they tell you to take a different job, it's not under the purview of kibud avim. You do not have to listen to them. There's a famous story about the Rav Soloveitchik, that when he was in university in Berlin, he fell in love with another graduate student there who was from a Litvisha family. She was from Vilna, and she wasn't so religious at the time she was in. And he wrote to his parents. He said, "Mazel tov, I'm engaged." So his father, his parents were furious because they were very, very both from very prominent rabbinic families. What is this? You marry someone who's barely from, she's just gonna observe all the mitzvahs when she marries you, but she's from a simple family, she's a university student, you can't marry her. So he wrote, his parents were already in America at the time, so he wrote his father a letter, which is a halachic treatise on why he doesn't have to listen to him, because due to the mitzvah of kibud avim. So apparently his father showed the letter, he held the letter up in front of his students here at YU, and you know, with tears on his face, he said, "Oh, my son is such a genius, he always such a beautiful letter," even though he was opposed to the whole idea. He still wasn't happy with the shidduch, but he was just so happy that his son wrote him such a learned, very, very analytical halachic letter explaining why he wasn't going to listen to him. Yeah, they got married, of course. V'chi chayav l'chabdo b'chayav uvamoso. That not only do you have to honor your parents when they are alive, you have to honor them after their death also. So how do you do that? So basically, when you discuss them after they die, within the first 12 months, you're supposed to say, "Oh, my father, Hareni Kaparas Mishkavo, I am the atonement of his resting place." It's a little bit of a funny lesson. Yeah, you say, "My father, my mother, Hareni Kaparas Mishkavo, or Mishkava, used to do this, or used to say this," or there's a machlokes about if you're writing, if you have to write Hareni Kaparas Mishkavo, because people might read it after the 12 months. So there's not it's only a din in the first 12 months, so you don't necessarily have to write any kaparos mishkav when you're writing, but the Rama says that the minhag is to be machmir about that. And you see all over the poskim, they write, all the poskim write, Shamati me'abba mari harei kaparos mishkav, and we're reading it 500 years later. So that's...
Is that a standard abbreviation?
Hey Chaf Mem, Harini Kaparas Mishkava or Mishkava, yeah. And after 12 months, you just say, Zichron El Vracha, Zichron El Chaim Olam Haba, you can be extensive, Zichar Tadek Vikarash Levracha Lechai Olam Haba. See, very long invitation, abbreviations about after the names of people, sometimes after they die, but you're supposed to say these things when your parent hates Aru Akibud Bimoso, we just said that, how you honor someone after death. The Yeser Prata, the rest of the details, Mevorim B'Kiddushin, they're explained the Maseches Kiddushin of all places, Uktas Men B'Mekomos B'Talmud, and in certain other places in the Gemara. V'Noheges B'Chol Makom V'Chol Zman, it's applicable in all places and all time, B'Zcharim V'Nikevos Kol Zman She'efshar Lahen, it's applicable to males, but to females only when it's possible for them. What does that mean? Since when do we have mitzvahs that women only have to do when they can? No, you have to do mitzvahs all the time. It's not a mitzvah seishu, it's not zman grama. Not zman grama, it's applicable at all times. You have to honor your parents even if they wake you up at 2 in the morning and they ask you for a steak. Kolomar, b'chol eis shelo yimnu osan ba'alehen. That a woman's first obligation is to her husband. So if her father calls her up and says, I want you to make me some eggs now, then she's busy cooking dinner for the kids or for her husband, if she's busy dealing with her own family, then she's not required to go listen to her father or her parents' requests. Although it's a good idea for husbands to encourage their wives to still honor their parents as much as possible and be as available to them as possible, it fosters good connections between children-in-law and parents. In law, v'over aleha bitel asei. If you violate this, you violated the mitzvah. Asei v'onsho gadol me'od shenase k'misnakir lavim shebashamayim. It has a very great punishment because it's like you are distant. You made yourself alien to your father in heaven because, as we said, there's sort of a connection between parents and God. Oh, by the way, in terms of honoring grandparents. So this is not really part of the mitzvah d'oraisa per se, but and the poskim discuss, which grandparents, you have to honor your father's father, but maybe not your mother's mother. I mean, the poskim discuss exactly which grandparents you technically are required to honor and which ones you're not, but recommend that you should honor all your grandparents. That's what you should do. Also, it's brought down that what a person should honor his father's wife, even if it's not his mother. It's fun, but your mother's house, honoring your mother's house. Yeah, we can't just stick to the exact literal word for word the letter of the law, but we have to work with the spirit of the law also. Clearly, this is part of instilling with us the midah of hakaras hatov, and making your parents happy and your grandparents happy is all part of the same package. Technically, honoring one's older brother is directly connected to the mitzvah than honoring one's grandparents, but...
But technically, when you honor your grandparents, you honor your parents.
Yeah, but it's not part of the... kibbud is something that has to do with a parent's body. In other words, feeding them or putting clothes on them. So just because it makes them happy that you honor their parents, that's not kibbud. That's a good idea.
For them, but it's not kibbud. But they would have to do for their parents. So you're kind
of relieving them of duties.
It's not personal.
I don't think so. That's not technically under the parameters of the mitzvah, but again, not advisable to stick directly to the exact parameters of the mitzvah. When your parents ask you to do something, or your grandparents ask you to do something, or something nice you could do for your parents or grandparents or older siblings, or younger siblings for that matter, we don't have to look in the Shulchan Aruch and say, oh, I didn't find that anywhere that I have to do that. No, you have to use sense. V'im yesh koach b'vezdin kofen oso. The Bezin can force him to do it. Chmoshe kasu lemala shebevitol asei kofin Bezdin. Now, there's a little bit of an issue with this because Because normally we find that when a mitzvah has its reward written explicitly in the Torah, right next to it, a mitzvah says, Shematan Schara Betzida, that it says, it says, honor your mother and your father so that your days may be increased. So since it tells you explicitly what the reward is, so normally Beis Din do not force you to comply with those mitzvos because the reward is already there. You could see it. What do they need to force you for? But some of the commentators here explain that could be what they say for Hachinuch means is that the Beis Din can, if they want to, force you to do the mitzvah. The next mitzvah is mitzvah Lamed Daled, the 34th mitzvah. Shelo la'arog nefesh. Just don't kill people. Shenamar lo tirtzach. It says specifically, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not murder, however you want to translate it. People don't like to translate it, thou shalt not kill, because there are situations where killing is required. So Shorish Mitzvah, what's the reason for this mitzvah? Yaduah v'nigla l'chol roi ha-shemesh, anybody who sees the sun, ki Hashem yizbarach, bana ha-olam v'tzivanu lifros v'lirbos, is part of, connected to the mitzvah of Piri v'rivya, to having children, that God wants people to live in the world, kidei li'ashro l'fanov, that God wants the world to be populated. U'mina anu shelo nacharivehu biyadeinu l'harog ul'abed ha-brio she'ina mi'ashros olam. So that's the reason. You're not supposed to kill people because they're the population. So if you kill someone, you're reducing the population. We want to increase the population. The ulam, however, there's an exception to this. Harishoyim hagimurim, real evildoers, really wicked people. Kigon haminin, the hamalshinim, people who are completely heretical or slander the Jewish people in different ways to the non-Jewish authorities and get them in trouble. Einon miyashvei holam. They don't count as population. They're not even real. We don't want them around. Balehem, again, it's limited to real evildoers who are farbrent, as we might say, against the Jewish people and against what they stand for, and they're trying to do us in and do us harm. But people who are not strictly Orthodox Jews, are obviously, it goes without saying, are not at all in this categorization. Ve'aleihem amar akosuv. That's what the pasuk says. Uve'avod rishoyim rina. When evildoers are destroyed, there should be joy. Levi shehein lo yoshivu ha'olam aval yachriveu bechol kocham. They're trying to destroy the world, so there's no point. Their existence doesn't help populate the world. Ve'zehu ma'asha amar chacham mechachamenu zichronim livracha. One of our chachamim said, Be'abdo harishayim, when he was destroying wicked people, kotzim ani mechala min hakerem, I'm getting rid of thorns from the vineyard. They're just, they don't belong here. They're just destroying the real produce. Kelomar be'avdan eila yisyashiv ha'olam yosar. When these people are destroyed, there's more chance for population growth in the world and for the betterment of society. Kimosha perus haker misrabim v'tovim, that the grapes grow better, basilu kakotzi mimena, when you get rid of the thorns from the vineyard. Also, this certainly doesn't apply not only to people who are really out to do us in, which it's mutter to kill them at any time, but, again, has to be with much yishuvadas, and not recommended normally to do this nowadays because it's going to give people a bad name and the secular authorities will be on you. But technically, if their people are really out to do evil to the Jewish people, then it's mutter for anyone to kill them. But also, if someone is chayamisa, of course, somebody is subject to the death penalty in a proper Jewish fashion, declared guilty in a Jewish court, convicted in a Jewish court that they had in the olden days with a real smicha, with at least 23 judges, then, of course, that would also not fall under the purview of lo tirtzach, because that's something where you're commanded to kill people. Midine ha-mitzvah, the halachos of the mitzvah, ma'asha amr zichronim livracha, she'echad ha-horeges ha-bori o esacholen natoi lamos. It doesn't matter if you kill someone who's completely healthy, or if someone is about to die. So this is a major matter of ethical concern to the community at large nowadays. What if people are, I mean, it's the whole issue surrounding brain death also. If somebody, question is, someone's brain dead, is are they dead according to halacha as well, or just according to societal definitions? Or are they still alive? Are they achole natoi lamus? And it's completely, because if they're only achole natoi lamus, then it's completely ritzicha to kill them, or to harvest organs, or any of these things. So I refer you to an excellent book that was written recently by a friend of mine, Rabbi Dr. David Shabtai, called Defining the Moment, where he discusses all the different approaches to brain death. He doesn't there share what his actual personal halakha conclusions are, but if you wish to speak to him about that, sure, he'd be more than willing to discuss it with you as well. But these are major issues that the poskim nowadays are working on. What is considered, at what point is it mutter to pull the plug of a ventilator? You're allowed to withhold treatment. If somebody doesn't want to be put on a ventilator in the first place, there's no obligation to extend their life as long as possible. But once the ventilator is in and they're on it, you have serious problems removing it. That would be ritzicha. That would be prohibited by the Ten Commandments of Lo Sirtzach. If somebody's not only in a, if somebody's with an extended illness who's on his way to death, but really someone who's literally mamish on the verge of death, there's absolutely no hope whatsoever. That's called a goses, and it's not exactly clear what a goses is. So we try not, again, there's a halacha in Hilchas Avelos that if somebody's a goses, someone's mamish on the verge of death, you're not supposed to touch them, you're not supposed to do anything lest you hasten their death. So there is a story about Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach and one of his compatriots who was a doctor, I forget, Dr. Avram, I think. And they were dealing with someone who was very ill. So the doctor asked Rav Shlomo Zalman, so is this person a goses? So Rav Shlomo Zalman answered, you're the doctor, you tell me. I don't know exactly. It doesn't discuss anywhere in halacha exactly what are the signs of a goses. It's a little bit unclear. But other cholim who are not toilomos, as the Sefer Chinuch says them, you're allowed to administer proper treatment to, and it's assuming they're not going to die just because you move them in the wrong direction. So now ragalov, so you could be given the death penalty, which is a normal punishment for violating the lo sirtzach prohibition, even if you kill someone who's literally on the verge of death, because for all halachic intents and purposes, they are still completely alive. There's no, a little bit dead in halacha. There's either you're dead or alive. It's very black and white. V'din mishpat harotzeach keitzad. V'yeser prateha mivorim eperek tes misanhedrin v'shein mimakos. And the exact halachos of what happens when you murder someone, the penalty of that's administered in Bezdin, also what happens if you kill someone accidentally, which he'll discuss a little bit later. I'll go into it as soon as we finish. So that's in the ninth parak of Sanhedrin and the second parak of Makos. V'nohegis b'chol makom v'chol zman. It's in all places and all times. B'zicharim u'nikevos. For males and females. We would have no reason to assume that a woman would be allowed to kill people to her heart's content and a man not. V'ovar aleha v'ratzach. Let's say you do kill someone, memezid v'yesh edim shehisrubo. If you do it on purpose and there are witnesses to testify to that fact that they warned him before he killed him and he said, I'm doing it anyway, then he receives horginoso b'sayif. He receives the death penalty of sword. So even if it doesn't match the way you killed the person, you still receive the death penalty of death by sword, beheading, if you kill someone. That's also if there's no what we call goel hadam. If they're close family members who would have to sit shiva for that person, if they have for killing you in retaliation, falls on the family member, the very close family members. The Bezdin only does this if there are no family members. They didn't bishogi. Let's say you kill someone accidentally. Lamata nichtavos dino bezras Hashem beseder elamase. Later on in Sefer Bamidbar, it discusses the halacha of ir miklat, that if you kill someone accidentally, you have to go into the ir miklat, and then you get released at a certain point when the Kohen Gadol dies. And till that time, you have to stay in the ir miklat, in the city of refuge, and if you leave the city of refuge, then the goel hadam could still kill you. So Right. So you have to, the Goel Adam technically doesn't have a right to kill you once you're in the Ir Miklat. So there, right. So it's only if there is no Goel Adam that you, that the Beis Din would administer the penalty of Saif, of killing by sword, death penalty by sword. This is also one of the mitzvos that apply to non-Jews as well. The non-Jews are not supposed to, one of the mitzvos of Bnei Noach, they're not supposed to, not supposed to kill other people. Moving right along. Mitzvah Lamed Hei, the 35th mitzvah. Shelo legalos ervas eishes ish. One should not reveal the nakedness of a married woman. So what does that mean? Shelo lovo al eishes ish. We should not have relations with a married woman. Unless she's your wife, obviously. Shenemar lo sinaf. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Uba perush, the accepted explanation of this mitzvah is, Shelosho niuf stam. When it just says niuf for adultery, I guess maybe a better translation would be fornication, because the English word adultery has a clear connotation of breaking marital bonds, vows. So in the niuf per se doesn't have that connotation directly. It's just we assume that when the Torah talks about regular fornication without any qualification, it means mashma beishes ish. It means that it's a man having relations with a woman who is married. Because it doesn't apply the other way around, because technically, midaraisa, a man is allowed to have more than one wife. So a man is not bound in the same way to his wife as the wife is to her husband. Nowadays, we are only allowed to have one wife because of takanas rabbeinu gershom, and because that's the minag. So the minag is binding. So it's still highly, highly, highly not recommended for a man to have relations with anyone other than his wife. Even in those times, it probably wasn't such a good idea, rather than his wives. And again, there is also a prohibition to have relations outside of the context of marriage. So it's definitely forbidden, but it's not the what the Ten Commandments here are talking about. Of Lo Sinaf is talking about a married woman having relations with a man other than her husband. Kemo she'amru zichronim livracha, as the Chazal tell us, a niuf ela beishes ish, that the fornication means with a married woman. V'nichpal zehala b'seder achrei mos, it's repeated later on in the book of Vayikra. Shekasu sham b'feirosh, it says explicitly, V'al eishes amischa lo sitein shchavtecha lezara letamava. For to, you shall not give your lying to the wife of your friend to become impure due to that. That's considered a very impure action, to say the least. Mishor she mitzvah zo, what's the reasoning for this mitzvah? And this is a little bit of a funny paragraph in the Sefer Chinuch, as you're about to see, because it says Kadesh Yashiv Ha'olam Kasher Chafetz Hashem, that the reason for this mitzvah, what would you think the reason is? Because it creates disharmony. People are going to be furious with each other if they go around committing adultery, which he does bring in a little bit at the end, just to give you a preview. But he goes on this whole lengthy paragraph explaining that the, which is we should learn a lesson from. It's a very interesting point of the Sefer Chinuch, that he says that the main reason is Kadeshi Yisyashiv Olam Kasher Chafetz Hashem, that the earth should be populated according to the will of God. The Hashem Baruch Hu Ratza Sheyu Kol Inyone Olamo Osin Perusan Kol Echad Vechad Leminehu. God's plan for the world is that all the things that happen in the world should be, or all creatures, I guess, should be fruitful, each with its own type. Veloshi is arbu min b'min acher. So he doesn't want different types to be mixed up with each other. So what does that mean over here? V'chein rotzah she'yeh zera ha'anashim yadua. God wanted it to be known which children, who are the parents of each child. Shel mihu v'lo yizarvu zeim zeh. The offspring of different people shouldn't be mixed up from each other. We should know exactly. The mother, you obviously always know, but the reason that a man is not allowed to, is not only allowed to have relations with a specific woman, or really the other way around, the woman who you know whose offspring are hers, she's only allowed to have relations with a certain man because you want to know who the father of her offspring are. Now, I guess nowadays it's not necessarily so clear that you always know who the mother is, just because the baby comes out of a certain woman's uterus, it doesn't mean that that woman was the genetic mother. So this has, in cases such as in vitro fertilization, where you, or surrogate motherhood, where you combine the sperm and the egg from a man and a woman, and then you can implant it into another woman. So that creates halachic issues. There's a very big, especially in terms of who the father is halachically is not such so important for these purposes. I mean, it's obviously good to know in terms of yichus, like the Sefer HaChinuch is telling you over here that if God wants it to be known who are the parents of each child. But more important is for determining Jewish status. So as we all know, it's the mother who determines whether the child is Jewish or not. Mm-hmm. So the main question is it the genetic mother who donated the egg, or is it the mother who gestated the baby? And we're going to have even more shilas if they invent the artificial wombs and if they implant the nucleus of one egg into another egg, and it's going to create all sorts of major shilas that the big postgame will have to discuss. But in terms of technology as it exists nowadays, the real question is, who's the halachic mother? Is it the genetic mother or the gestational mother? So there are many different opinions about this. So Rabbi Bleich's opinion, I happen to know offhand, very, very, very great scholar. His opinion is, I don't have a personal opinion on these issues. I'm not qualified, but his opinion is that the gestational mother is vadai considered the mother. That in halacha there's a precedent for that the gestational mother is the one that creates a maternal relationship. But the genetic mother is the suffix mother. There's still a doubt as to whether the genetic mother could be considered the mother. So we really have, according to Rabbi Bleich, there are basically two options. One is that we don't look at the genetic mother at all, and the baby just has one mother, which is the gestational mother. Or, halachically speaking, the baby has two mothers. And how we resolve that is a major problem. If both mothers are Jewish, then we have less of a problem. If the egg donor and the gestational mother are both Jewish, then the child is certainly Jewish. But the question is, then we get into problems of if one has maternal relatives, first of that one's not allowed to marry, or one's not allowed to be an aide, mm-hmm. not allowed to be a witness for one's maternal relatives. So which set do you go by? Very, very major shilas. Yeah, but that,
first?
What?
Which mother do you honor first?
Right, which Ooh. Mother do you honor first? The vadai, you honor the gestational mother first. If you're a gestational mother and your genetic mother ask you to bring them water at the same time, you honor the gestational mother first. That's a vadai, and the other is a suffix. At least according to Rabbi Bleich. Others may disagree. But clearly, that concept here is going against the Sefer HaChinuch's presentation of this mitzvah. Because the way Sefer HaChinuch is presenting it is that God wants it to be clear who the mother and father are of each child, which is also a pasuk which says, "Umala ha'aret zima," that Chazal interpret that the earth should be filled with licentiousness. The Chazal interpret this to mean that to apply to, let's say, someone has two wives in two different cities. So there might be, so one shouldn't do that because there could be two siblings. They don't know they have the same father. They just grew up with their mother in different cities. They don't know they have the same father, and then they might want to get married. So that's why it's a part of the concern of the Torah that everybody should know their lineage. And it's considered very important. So all not only halachically, but hashkafically, what to do with all these technologies. It's certainly, say in Egypt, but that's an ervan anyway in the Torah. You're not allowed to, of course, you're not allowed to marry your sibling, but the question is that you shouldn't do an action that might potentially cause someone to be nichshal in something that's usur because they don't know any better. You, in other words, the isur, these two siblings, who had no idea they were siblings, they wanted to marry each other because their father had two wives and never told them. That's the father's problem. It's the father's isser that he violated Umala Harat Zima. That's Umala Harat Zima. The Od Yimtzu Kama have said in Beniyuf, there are a lot of other problems with adultery. Shetia Sibo Levatel Kama Mimitzos Hakel Aleinu. that if you don't know your parentage, then you have problems with fulfilling certain mitzvahs. Shetzivanu bekibud ha'avos velo yukru labanim im haniyuf. So if, let's say, you don't know who your parents are, so you can't fulfill the mitzvah of kibud ha'avim properly. If there are other mitzvahs involving parents and yerushas and inheriting, they have to know who your parents are. It's very important. Vodiye kishalon v'mashen itztavinu gamkein lo lavo al ha'achos val harbe nashim. Right, so just like we're commanded, there'll be failure in this regard, regarding the commandment not to have relations with one sister, and on many other women that are relatives. V'akol ye'aker b'sivos aniyuf. If you don't know, like I just said, who your relatives are on each side of the family, you're not going to know who you're not allowed to marry. Shelo yakiru b'nei adam krovaseyam. People won't realize who their relatives are. Milvad she'yesh b'nyan haniyuf imeshes ish tzad gezel. This is where we're getting into the more of the mitzvahs, the reasons to not to commit adultery that we might think of on a more day-to-day basis. That it's like stealing. It's a bad midah. You're taking something that's not yours. Shehu davar barush aseichel marchiko. You don't need my whole sefer achinuch explanation for. Everybody knows they're not supposed to take something that's not yours, and having relations with someone else's wife is doing something, taking something that's not yours. It's not yours to have relations with. V'gam ki hu siba li'ibud nefashos. It's also a reason that the world might become dispopulated. How? Ki yadua hadavar b'teva b'nei adam, shemekanim al niyuf bazuganim acherem. Men don't like it when their wives have affairs. So v'yordanim hanoif ad l'chayav, then they are going to pursue the adulterer to the last, and might be so incensed that they actually kill the adulterer, as has happened many times in history. We know v'chama takolos milavad eila. Not only that, there are many other reasons to avoid. There are other things that are going to come from committing adultery that are not even discussed here. There are many scenarios you could imagine why committing adultery is not a good idea. Dinei ha-mitzvah, al-hukhaz ha-mitzvah, kigon ha-chokas ha-inyan shelo li-siyachet imahen, that not only it says lo sikrivu legalo serva, that as we'll discuss when we get more into the actual parsha of the Arayos, it says one should not come close to revealing the nakedness. So for that reason, we are not allowed to touch people we're not allowed to marry in a manner that shows that we're we like them, and that so you're not allowed. But I mean, tapping a woman on the shoulder is technically not in this, although because you say nowadays it's pasnished, that it's not something done nowadays. But still, technically, the only thing that's technically prohibited, whether midarais or midarabanan, it's a machlokes between the Rambam and the Ramban, is to touch someone in a way that's sexually exciting. It's an issue also by shaking hands. That you have opinions from one extreme to the other. Some say that shaking hands, if a woman extends her hand to you, there's one opinion that says it's a harig val yavor, that it's considered like gilui arayos. It's prohibited sexual relationships. It's not exactly, but it's leading to that, which is also under the rubric of yaharig val yavor, that one should be killed rather than. One should allow oneself to be killed rather than violate, just like the general category of gilui arayos, of impermissible sexual relationships. Others say it's mutter, that that's not considered a sexual at all. It's not a sexual gesture at all. That's the accepted psak in YU. In more Haredi circles, even if a woman extends her hand and she'll be embarrassed if you don't shake it, they won't normally shake hands. I heard testimony that once Moshe Feinstein shook a woman's hand, but the accepted psak in modern, quote-unquote, modern Orthodox circles, even the more right-wing, is that if a woman extends her hand to you, and it would be, obviously one should not do that lechatchila, one shouldn't put oneself in a situation where you have to do that, but you are allowed to shake it, you're allowed to take her hand if she extends it to you, and she'd be embarrassed if you didn't shake it. There's a story also about when Rav Avadia Yosef was getting Pras Yisrael, and he was in the ceremony when he was getting a prize for all his work, his tshuva svarim. So at that time, Golda Meir was the prime minister. So he walked across the stage to take his prize, and she extended her hand, and he did not shake it. But of course not. You're standing. That was different. That is different. The prime minister, the woman prime minister of a Jewish country, extends her hand to the chief rabbi. I mean, come on. So of course, that to show that even if he held it was technically mutter, it was in front of so many people, he didn't want to show that that was the halacha. And even so, she should know better. It's ridiculous. Of course, in that situation, one certainly makes sense not to shake hands, even if it technically might be mutter. Yeah, given the you shouldn't like.
Also,
yeah,
Shechter says also limp.
Yeah, limp. Right. You don't have to take the hand and caress the hand and shake. Give a limp, regular handshake. Yeah. There's also a story with Eleanor Roosevelt, that there was a delegation of rabbis that went down during World War II to help argue and plead for the cause of the European, that the U.S. should do more to help European Jewry as part of the war effort. So FDR refused to see them, but he sent them. He apparently, the First Lady received them. She was the consolation prize. So she extended her hand to the head of the rabbinic delegation, and he said, I'm sorry, but I'm not. We're not allowed to touch women to whom we're not married. So she said, "Oh, I wish my husband did that."
By the way, this is an instance of a gzeira deraisa.
A gzeira deraisa. Yeah, it's a siag deraisa. Gzeira deraisa. Yeah. That would be an example of that. Yeah. So sometimes, as I said, even though it might technically be mutter, there are situations, they probably held it was us, or these rabbanim, but even if they, certain official situations where you want to teach a lesson and the woman's not going to be terribly embarrassed, then it's probably better to refrain from shaking hands. Okay, on your own yichud, you're not allowed to be all secluded with an erva, especially a married woman. And there are many halachos about that, especially like if does it apply if the woman's husband is in town, really doesn't, or different heterim if there's an open door and people can see you. But basically, you should not be secluded alone with married women or any erva, any woman that you're not allowed to have relations with, including a single woman. Umishpat hanoef, what happens if you do commit adultery? Then one thing is that, well, we can discuss the punishment for committing adultery per se in a minute, but one thing to be aware of is that you might think, how could it possibly be proven that they committed adultery, that the witnesses would have to have a pretty good view for that? So the answer is that if it's the witnesses see the two people in a manner that suggests that they are having relations, that is sufficient grounds for the witnesses to testify that they saw them actually committing adultery. Technically speaking, they wouldn't be so subject to the penalty, to the death penalty or any heavenly penalties for the actual sin of committing adultery, even though it may be violated as a deraisa, certainly not recommended to engage in physicality with a married woman or any other impermissible sexual relationship. But technically, one shouldn't be chayiv unless one actually has intercourse. But if the witnesses see that the man and the woman are in bed together or something like that, or they're in a manner that suggests that that's what they're doing, then that's sufficient grounds, even if they're not actually, even if technically, God knows, so to speak, that they weren't actually having intercourse, then that is still sufficient grounds for the witnesses to testify to the Beis Din that they were committing adultery and they could be subject to all the penalties. In part of the Drishas V'Chakiras, they probably would give more details to show that their testimony was matching, but I don't... No, it can't be that. Not that. No. There is a principle of... sometimes that hein eide yichud v'hein eide bia. If there's two, there are witnesses that two people go into seclusion together, then it's as if they are testifying that they had relations. So, for example, one of the methods of getting married, of performing kiddushin, is through having relations. So, if the man and the woman stand outside a room, and they have two witnesses, and the man says harad mikudeshes li b'biazu, then you are married to me through this act of relations, then they go into the room together and the witnesses see that. That's sufficient to constitute kiddushin. But that doesn't
do that
does not we don't do right we do not do kiddushin in this manner nowadays. But that would not be sufficient for this. You have to actually see them in a manner that clearly suggests their impropriety. That's correct. Good point. The Esther Prateh, the rest of the details, Mivor B'Masechet Sanhedrin, are explained in the Tractate Sanhedrin, Uvekomos Talmud, other places in the Talmud. I'm sorry. V'anu Efes Gam Kein Shigam Hi B'Isser Uvadin. So it's the person... V'sham b'Sanhedrin, again in Masechet Sanhedrin, Mizbar sh'anoyef imeishas ish gemura shneim b'chenek. That a man who has an affair with a really married woman, a regular married woman, are both punished by strangulation. V'anoyef im naira me'arasa, but if there is a young 12-year-old betrothed woman, technically betrothed, so that she's really a full woman, full eishas ish, she's a full married woman for halachic purposes, but she still hasn't moved in with her husband. She just had kiddushin done on her, the sanctification stage where they declare that they're now married, but there's another stage, nisuin, where she moves in with her husband. So they haven't done that yet, but she's still completely considered to be a married woman. Then shneim biskilav, so the 12-year-old betrothed woman, not what we call betrothed, but halachically betrothed woman, then they're both punished by skila, by stoning. Imanaira marasa bas kohen, but if that young lady happens to be the daughter of a kohen, then he tisarev, there's a difference between her and her paramour, where she receives the death penalty by burning, and v'hu yechonik, and he receives the death penalty by strangulation. That, in other words, the halacha of skila is removed if she's a bas kohen, but rather you instead put on her the penalty of sreifa, which is the punishment for bas kohen jazinsa, a daughter of a priest who has an affair, and he receives the regular punishment for anyone who has an affair, and that would be strangulation. The prohibition of a married woman is not only for Jews, but for non-Jews as well. Ben Yisrael ben Goy. Aval yesh chiluk tzas benyan. There's one slight difference, which is that she'ein ishes lagoy el al yedei be'ila. The way two goyim get married is through having relations with each other, moving in together, and then when they want to separate, they say, hey, let's get divorced, and they can go their merry ways. But Yisrael kona osa afilo b'kiddushin, but for terms of Jewish marriage, once he performs whether he performs a betrothal on her by way of something of monetary value, or with a document, or through relations, then she becomes completely a married woman, even though she hasn't moved in with him yet. And the full penalties apply of having an affair with a married woman. And again, of course, for a divorce for a Jew, that is only accomplished by means of a get, of a written instrument of divorce. And by the goy, they just decide to separate and they can.